This episode of The Other 22 Hours is brought to you by Yamaha Guitars. 2026 marks the 60th anniversary of Yamaha Guitars. That's six decades of innovation, expertise, and instruments that have inspired players like John Denver, Bob Dylan, Elliott Smith, Billy Corgan, and Keith Urban. From legendary FG Red Label guitars to modern innovations like their Transacoustic series, Yamaha continues to set the gold standard for acoustic guitar craftsmanship worldwide. To celebrate 60 years of guitar excellence, visit Yamaha.com and stop by your local Yamaha dealer today.
I have to basically tell him you can't try to micromanage my travel plans because he loves looking up alternate routes that would like get me there faster or like make more sense with routing. He actually did find me a better flight and then I was able to switch my flight. I'm like, this is helpful, but like, no, I don't want to change my whole plan last minute and annoy my tour manager.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. Today we sit down with the Grammy Award-winning guitarist, banjo player, singer, and songwriter Molly Tuttle, who was also the first female to win the IBMA Guitarist of the Year Award, and who has shared the stage with an incredible list of people, to just name a few, being Ringo Starr, Billy Strings, and recent guests Ray Benson and Jeff Hanna, also the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah, and this conversation is really interesting. We got to dig into kind of the main theme being how to trust your gut in a life that is constantly changing, whether that's you're navigating the change of genre fluidity in your artistic expression or the constant change and instability of music as your career path, whether things are going well or not.
Something we can all relate to. So with that, please enjoy our conversation with Molly Tuttle.
So we always like to start our conversations with just the real question of how are you today and where are you physically and creatively?
Yeah, I'm home in Nashville. I leave for tour tomorrow. I'm doing good today. I just had like a chill day, made some coffee and then had another interview this morning and then a label meeting. And yeah, it's been good. I guess I got my wires crossed on this because I was getting confused. My label's on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. I thought I scheduled my day and then my manager texted me that we had two things booked at the same time. So that's kind of typical when I try to avoid setting my own schedule and having my managers do it because I always cause chaos when I schedule things myself.
Yeah, time zones are so wild. There was a minute where I was doing work being here in Nashville and coordinate between people that were in Hawaii and in Madrid.
Oh, God.
So
Hawaii's
I was just like,
confusing.
They were on like a 12-hour spread between the two of them. I'm like, oh, I give up. This
is
so hard.
Well, also because the rest of the world doesn't have daylight savings either.
Yeah, that's confusing too. And then certain states like Arizona maybe doesn't have daylight savings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I worked at Nonsuch 15 years ago. So whoever you were meeting with might be some of my friends.
Yeah, David Byther.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
David. Known David since I was like 22, which
is crazy. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, he's the best.
David's record collection has been a lore of this podcast of like its depth and just the amount of music that it turned me onto from Michaela bringing stuff home.
Yeah.
Have you been to his office in person?
I finally did this last year. I hadn't been. I've put out now three records with them. And finally, with my last record release, I went to the Nonsuch headquarters. They had a little party there for the album, and that was fun. But I'd never seen it before, so.
Awesome. Well, it's a different location than it was when I worked there. It was like a library for he would just let me come in and pick records from his record collection and take them home. And
oh, that's super cool.
It was like postgraduate education for me musically. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I'm really curious about is kind of like how you balance your time. From the outside looking in, it looks like you're always on tour. And do you just love that? Or is there ever time where you have to be really intentional about I'm home from tour, but no, I can't do interviews. Or like, are you intentional about your space and time? Or are you just in the phase of life where you're just going with the flow and saying yes to everything?
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going with the flow. I have a hard time transitioning on and off tour. Like, I've been home for a week and a half and I'm like, I don't want to leave home. I get so used to the flow of being home. And then when I'm on tour, it's like I get into it and I have a lot of fun. But sometimes when I get back home, I totally crash for the first couple of days. I try to be a little mindful of like stuff I say yes to, especially if my tour schedule gets really, really hectic. Mm-hmm. This year, I only have had one tour so far. I was in Europe and the UK for 3 weeks. I got back last week. I was opening up for Tyler Childers. But that was my first tour of the year. I did a couple things that I traveled to in January, but they weren't shows. So yeah, I've been trying to get to all the stuff that I wasn't able to say yes to in the fall because I was just going super hard and barely home at all. So now I'm just kind of having fun doing stuff around town and doing stuff like this, like podcasts and interviews, trying to do it while I can before stuff gets busy again. So yeah, it's a bit of a balance. But if I'm excited about stuff, I try to say yes and then just figure it out when I'm back. But yeah, it can be tough. Sometimes I get home and I feel like I'm even busier than I was on tour.
For sure. I can understand that. It's like getting in the van or getting on the bus and you're like, oh, I have free time. I can't do anything else but this right now.
Suddenly you get to relax once you go on tour.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the vortex of tour. There's like an element of escapism. Mm-hmm. Even as busy as you are, it's just like in this one sphere that sometimes for better or worse, you're like leaving behind a lot of other obligations and maybe responsibilities or like doctor appointments, things that you just are like, oh, I don't have to deal with the tedium of life. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, totally.
Can you tell us a little bit for our audience? You've been playing music and touring and performing since a really young age. And I'm always like specifically interested in guests who this has been like their life for their entire life versus someone like me who loved music and took lessons, but it was always like a hobby. It wasn't like at the forefront of my life until honestly, like well into adulthood. Like this was always kind of like, I don't know if this is what I'm doing versus you or Chris Thiele or Sierra Hole. It just feels like you were born with instruments in your hand. Can you share a little bit about the way that you grew up and that as your kind of foundation?
Yeah, so I grew up in a musical household. My dad's a music teacher. He didn't teach in schools or anything like that, but he taught private lessons, mostly to adults, but some kids as well. And he teaches all the bluegrass instruments. He still teaches over Zoom. Sometimes he'll teach lessons in the backyard and stuff. Mm-hmm. It changed for him during COVID. He was teaching out of a music store since he moved out to the Bay Area in the 70s and found this music store in Palo Alto where I grew up that needed a banjo teacher, and he started teaching bluegrass, and they had all these rooms at the store, some of them bigger rooms where he could teach group classes. He would teach bluegrass jam classes, and that was fun for me as a kid because he had some students who were my age and we would have kids jam classes and make little bands. We'd perform around just at local spots. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's how I got started. My dad was my first guitar teacher. It really was something I gravitated towards, though, even though I'm sure he was really excited when I wanted to play music. It was kind of led by me being like, I want a guitar, I want a violin, I want to take piano lessons. I had a couple other teachers, like I took piano lessons, I took Suzuki lessons a tiny bit as a kid. But then when I got a guitar and my dad started showing me chords and stuff, I really took to it. And then after a couple years, I was practicing more and more and then forming little bands. And then my brother started playing too, and we would play together with my dad. So yeah, it sort of became a family band. And that was my first experience of playing at festivals, traveling to the East Coast to play here and there. That didn't happen too often, but every so often we got like a show offer in the East and we would travel from California. Mostly played around California though, so that was fun. And then I went to Berklee College of Music after high school and still wasn't really touring, but playing more shows under my own name and putting together my own bands. And yeah, then I moved to Nashville after a couple of years at Berklee.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw you, you were in a band opening for the Milk Carton Kids.
Yeah, that was actually the first band I ever went on an official tour with. It was called the Goodbye Girls. We were an all-girl kind of string band. And we started because the fiddle player, Liena, she was from Sweden, and a booking agent wanted to book her like a two-week tour and asked her to put together a band of Berklee students because he wanted to bring over people from the U.S., So yeah, we had a tour booked before we were even really officially a band.
Amazing.
We asked our friend Allison DeGroote, played banjo, and then Allison suggested me to play guitar, and then I was like, my roommate Brittany Carlson plays the bass. So we just put together the band we would rehearse in between our classes at Berkeley. And then we went on tour that summer in Sweden, which was my first time getting to like tour in Europe and also really go on an extended tour. So that was super exciting.
Has like music becoming a business for you? And as you are on like a bigger and bigger stage, literal stages, but also, you know, winning Grammys and playing with people like Ringo Starr, has that changed in any way, like your relationship to your writing and your playing?
Yeah, I think like now when I write, I kind of have a sense for what's going to work well in the live show. And then there's always some songs that I think maybe if they're like more ballads or less of like a live show fixture, I still like to record them, but I do kind of have an ear for like what's going to work well in the show. Like what do I need? What kind of different songs do I not have already in the live show, or what's going to be like a really cool moment to play live? And I'm not always right about like what's going to work well live, but I do feel like as I've gotten more performance experience, I kind of just think about that more, since so much of what I do is touring. I wish I could be in the studio making records all the time, but that's maybe like less than 10% of it, and the rest is touring. So
yeah, with being on tour, like what is like your creative time look like to write, to prepare for records? You know, in my perception, it's not like you're making like the same record over and over again. I notice like very much eras in like what you make and how you make, which is like something that draws me to your music and your output. So like, how do you find time for that? And how does that fit into like bouncing all over the place?
Yeah, I'm always trying to squeeze in writing, and I really get more into it when I'm home more often. So it's been nice the last couple of years, like the winter, I'll kind of slow down and have a couple months at home. And then I find myself just gravitating towards writing and having a lot more ideas. When I'm on tour, that can be a little trickier, and I just am more focused on putting on the show and all the stuff that goes into the show and keeping my energy up for that. Maybe working up new covers or new songs that I've already recorded and like thinking about the set lists. And that just takes up so much of my brain space on tour that if we have like a few days off, I might try writing. But a lot of times I sort of get out of the habit, and then it takes some time at home to really get into it again. But it's always in the back of my mind that I need to be writing new songs. Every time I get to go back in the studio and make a record, it's like my favorite. So I'm always just trying to work on that next collection of songs and think about what I want to do next.
Can you talk a little about your very bluegrassy band, Golden Highway, that was gaining a lot of success? And then your most recent record was perceived as a bit of a pivot with a whole new band, very overtly an all-female band with more of like a rock vibe.
Yeah.
And like Erin said, we both really love when people don't stay in their lane, when they don't stay in the box that they've been put in. But career-wise, professionally, that can be risky and scary. And I'm also super curious, like playing in the bluegrass world, Erin played drums with you, and he played for that one tour. And then he played with the Stray Birds too. And he jokes about like the bluegrass fans being like, what are you doing here, drummer? Like,
I don't even know if I told you. We played, I want to say it was like the Ozark Mountain Center. We were somewhere in Arkansas in like an amphitheater. There wasn't really a big backstage. So I think I was giving everybody else space and I was warming up, like just sitting like outside on the curb. And somebody walked by and stopped and like looked at me and was like, are you playing with Molly? You know, with drumsticks in my hand. I was like, yep. And he looked like he looked at me like I was a ghost, and I was like, yeah, we have electric guitar too. And his jaw like hit the floor.
Yeah, so I'm curious if you can talk about kind of navigating that, if you even like pay attention to it, and if it was like anything that you anticipated or considered, as well as like your creative motivation and just pursuing a different sound.
Yeah, I think for me the sound is always dictated by the songs. And when we went in and recorded my record, it was something I'd been planning for a while. I was just returning to making a solo record after the two Golden Highway albums, so it didn't feel like a huge abrupt out of the blue thing that I was doing. And so it gave me time to, you know, put the band together, because the music was so different. I was like, if I really want to tour this album and make it sound like the record, it's gonna have to be a different band. That was just led by the music, but it also sort of worked well for everyone's timelines and the Golden Highway, and it let Shelby and Bronwyn and Kyle and Dom, they're all kind of doing their own projects now too. So that was something we talked about too as a band. It's like important for people to not get stuck doing one thing. Like everyone has so many different projects they want to work on. So yeah, it was just an exciting shift for me. And then just coming up with ways to still be able to play all my bluegrass material too, and like find band members who can break down and do like a bluegrass portion of the set around one mic, mm-hmm. and then build up to a more rock sound at times too. That was an exciting challenge and something that I think made the show really fun and dynamic for all of us, is just the variation of playing stuff from all my different albums. So yeah, that's been fun. And I think that's sort of informed to like what I want to do next, is finding ways to thread all these different styles together.
Yeah, I love that. I also realize I said you formed an overtly female band. I don't really know what that means, overtly.
I'll give you the breaking news story, because Ellen Angelico has decided she wants to stay off the road this year. She wants to focus on stuff at home. And now we've introduced a male into the band.
No.
Carl Smakula will be playing with us.
Yeah.
Which I never had any intention of making an, as you said, overtly female band. So
yeah.
I'm not like gonna start discriminating against having men in the band. But Carl is awesome. He's a great banjo player, mandolin player, and also plays pedal steel and electric. And
amazing.
It's gonna be so fun. We have our first rehearsals coming up next week. So nice. I'm excited. And yeah, sad to not be hanging out with Ellen, because she's super, I know you guys
Ellen's
are
friends. Amazing, yes.
So yeah, she's incredibly talented.
Yeah.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice, or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
The whole intentionally or not, like forming a female band, like it was like news when you shared who your band was, which also is irritating, because it's unfortunate how rare it is to see a band made up of only women. It is a thing, though, because of women are so underrepresented in the music industry. There's always countless statistics. And especially for you being a female in the bluegrass world who plays lead guitar, still percentage-wise, there's not a ton out there on big stages. I don't want to say there aren't a ton out there, because I think it's often like a perpetual cycle of maybe there are a lot more out there that we just don't know about because they don't get the support. And I'm curious if you have any feelings. I know you are an advocate and outspoken about a lot of different things. I'm curious about that kind of role in your life, being a young woman that has grown up in this world and kind of like breaking boundaries in the way that you play, that unfortunately shouldn't have anything to do with our genders, but the way of our world, it does. It's notable.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny to me because I've never had any problem finding women to hire. Like, I don't even go out of my way and end up with all female lineups. And same thing with that band I was talking about, the Goodbye Girls. We didn't have any intention to make it an all female band. It just so happened. So I'm like, it's not hard to hire women at all. Like, there's so many women in Nashville who are side musicians or leading their own bands. So I don't really know what the holdup is, or like why you see so many bands that still don't have women in them, because it's really never been challenging at all. Like, I don't go out of my way, and I've pretty much always had women playing in my bands with me. And then I also have a project that I've done here and there called The First Ladies of Bluegrass, which is all the women who have been the first ones to win their instrumentalist awards from IBMA. So there's Allison Brown, who was the first woman to win the Banjo Player of the Year award, and she was like the first woman, period, to win a instrumentalist award at the Bluegrass Music Awards. And then Sierra Hull, obviously on mandolin, Missy Raines on bass, and Becky Buller on fiddle. And yeah, we've kind of talked about it. Like, I don't like the pressure of feeling like you have to be a role model just because you're a woman. I don't think that's something that we make men do as much. But obviously you hope that if you're out there playing, that maybe it'll inspire people in the next generation to pick up an instrument. But it does seem like there's still far fewer, at least for like lead flat picking bluegrass guitar, which is already a pretty small pool of people. There are like a lot less women doing it than men. So I don't know exactly why that is, but hopefully that starts to shift a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, I think for better or worse, I think seeing more women on stage helps just give that idea that it's possible. I remember like living in New York and I had my guitar on my back and I was at a coffee shop and a little boy was standing in line behind me and he goes, "Look, Dad, she has a guitar. Girls don't play guitar." And I was like, "Oh, buddy." But yeah. I remember being in band when I was a kid and like being like, "Oh, I pick a flute," because whether it was like conscious or not, I was like, that's mm-hmm. what I also gravitated to the instrument. But yeah, I think it's an interesting thing that sometimes I don't even want to bring up or talk about because it continues to kind of put a spotlight on it. It shouldn't be a thing to be like, "Oh, wow, your band is made up of women."
Yeah, I mean, but you also, you don't hear people say like the all male band.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you don't have people like making social media posts where they highlight all of the bands that only have men in them.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is just called a poster for a festival.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still out there of like, of this festival roster, there's two bands that have women in them or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Personally, like ever since I started touring, being in close proximity with other musicians, mm-hmm. I just wanted other girls around. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I don't spend nearly as much time on the road as either of you, but I enjoy touring with women more than men too. That's like way more chill, way more light, way cleaner.
Yeah, I think
it's a lot cleaner.
Yeah, it's very rare that I've ever had a tour situation where there's not at least one other woman in my band or group, and I prefer it. Yeah. I want other women around. I want to know also how intentional you are with your days when you are home. Like, do you have any routines where you're like, maybe I need some time away from music? Does mm-hmm. that exist in your realm? Or is it always my day off, I'm going to choose to write or I'm going to be creative in this way? Or is there other parts of yourself that you've nurtured and spent time with?
I could definitely stand to have more hobbies outside of music. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times when I'm home, I am just doing other stuff that's not musical, going on walks, getting together with friends who I haven't seen in a while because I've been on tour, or, you know, just hanging around the house. Like, I'm not constantly playing music, and I do feel like I need those breaks from it so I don't get sick of it, I guess. I feel like at this point, do I have like baggage around, you know, making it my career and all the things it entails to like go on the road and travel so much, and it can be so exhausting. So sometimes you just don't want to think about that. And for me, like, it's helpful to have other things that I do and just kind of recenter my life, not strictly around my career. So I like playing music when I'm home, sometimes just having like a jam session or just playing for fun. That's also just like a nice way to get re-inspired too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Put the play back into playing.
Yeah,
music.
Totally.
What's the baggage around making music your career?
I think it's just stressful because, like, for me, like, I just want to be able to count on something. Like, I feel like I would do really well if I had a daily schedule that was always the same. Mm-hmm. And if I knew that I was going to have X amount of income for a year, this is my mm-hmm. schedule, this is what I can count on. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be all these ups and downs. So I just think it's a really unpredictable career and you never know what your schedule is going to look like. You're kind of at the mercy of what shows come in, and you might really hope for a certain thing and that doesn't happen, but then another really cool thing that you didn't even think of happens instead. Like, there's just so many surprises, and for me, someone who likes routine and predictability, that can, even when things are like going amazingly well, it can still be really stressful because you're still nervous about doing a good job and this and that. So mm-hmm. I have to deal with anxiety around it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that resonates with both of us, and it's in a way like a little bit refreshing to hear with somebody that has the schedule and the team and the longevity that you have had, that things are still unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know, I hear you saying what I feel and what I think Michaela feels was just like, cool, it's January 1st. I wonder what this year is going to look like. In
yeah.
that, like, you know, you have a kind of an idea, but there's still so much left up to question. Is
yeah.
that something that you address with your team? You know, is that something that you guys kind of shoot for and strive for, and like, what does that look like for you?
I let them know that I like to have things figured out earlier in advance, but there's kind of only so much you can do. Especially this year, I did so many headline tours last year that this year we're kind of focusing more on opening for bands. Like, we're going out and opening for Chris Stapleton, which I've never done before and I'm super excited about. But when you're trying to base the year more around other people's tours and doing more festivals and this and that, you are kind of at the mercy of when they are locking in stuff as well. So there's kind of only so much you can do.
Yeah.
And then I am doing headline stuff still. So that part of it we control, but it's more, instead of like booking an entire fall of just my schedule and my headline shows, it's more filling in the gaps around these other things that I'm doing. So I feel like it just varies so much year to year, how much you know in advance. So this year was one of the more figuring out stuff on the fly as it goes in, which was a little stressful.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I continually learn and think is important to highlight is that we often can think that having a quote unquote successful career is just like a product of being musically good enough. And I feel like there's so much more at play, and like having the mental strength and like the emotional strength to navigate the instability, the surprise, like you said, even the anxiety around like wanting to do a good job of being able to perform under pressure. So much of that are essential like determining factors that some of us just aren't built with. Have you found anything to help with that anxiety of practices or tricks or tools of whether it's like high pressure performance or just like the instability of income as a musician, when you're just like, sometimes it's flush and you're like, woohoo, I'm coasting and things are going great and I've got all this work. And then like another time you're just like, okay, I don't know what to do. And really having to balance and resist the urge to just spiral into panic because something always comes through. I've definitely been like working on ways to like manage that, because otherwise your emotions are just ruling you. They're just all over the place.
Yeah, I know. There's so many ups and downs. I don't know. I mean, I guess I just usually talk to my team if I'm feeling really concerned about something. Usually they're pretty good about helping me make a plan or talking about it. If I have to like call my agents, my managers, I feel like that always makes me feel better, is just feeling like I have that support system around me, you know, maybe even talking to my band or like my crew or this and that. Just kind of like not keeping it all inside, I guess, is helpful for me. I mean, I've tried like so many different things, whether it's like meditation or talking to a therapist, that can all be like so helpful. I think it's just keeping up with finding something that you can sort of keep a routine with, which is the tricky part.
Yeah, that's so hard when your schedule is all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, the routines that you find that you have time for and freedom to do while you're at home, all of a sudden you're in a stretch of being on the road for the summer. You're facing the same things mentally, but you don't have the same flexibility in your schedule or time or whatever
privacy.
It might be, or privacy.
Yeah, true.
To do what you need.
If you feel comfortable talking about it, I know you're partner in life is a lifelong musician. Ketch, has that felt helpful at all to be living life with someone who knows this unique lifestyle and has been doing it for a really long time?
Yeah, definitely. Because we both kind of have the same struggles and the same things that we're excited about. And, you know, we just talk about it constantly. Like, I think even though it's, you don't want to be talking about your career with your partner all the time, like we're both so invested in what we do and like so passionate about it. So we are basically like always updating each other on what's going on, what we're worried about, what we're excited about. So that's really helpful. And just if I need a pep talk, he's always gonna like give me a pep talk, whether I like ask for it or not. He's like a very good like cheerleader, which he is for like his friends and his bandmates too. I feel like that's why they've been able to do it for so long, but he's just such a big part of my support system.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we understand that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like brushing your teeth, talking about tour routing and you know, release strategy.
Yeah, like just yesterday I showed him my flight. I'm flying home from tour this weekend, and I have to basically tell him like, you can't try to micromanage my travel plans, because he loves looking up alternate routes that would like get me there faster or like make more sense with routing. And he's like obsessed with routing.
Yeah.
So he did find me a better flight, and then I was able to switch my flight. I'm like, this is helpful. But he's like, are you sure you are okay with me looking? Cause I just have to like look and see.
Oh yeah.
Cause sometimes I'm like, no, I don't want to change my whole plan last minute and annoy my tour manager and this and that. But
oh yeah, yeah. Man, that resonates. My mind like defaults to like efficiency and like all that.
I know.
I still suck at it, but I'm getting like a little bit better. Like, I can bite my tongue and be like, cool.
No, but it's totally
that's
beneficial.
Cool you're doing that.
Because I'm like, hey, it helps me too. Because even like, I mean, we've been together almost 20 years. So I remember even like when we lived in New York City, I'd be like, okay, this is what my schedule is today. I have to go to Williamsburg and then I have to go here. And I'm thinking I'm going to like take the train or maybe drive. And Aaron would be like, no, this is what you should do. And I'm like, yes, thank you.
It's a blessing and a curse. Yeah.
That's so funny.
We have two children now and I still want to tour. And Aaron's thankfully, like, he doesn't have any interest in touring, which makes our life easier.
Yeah.
A lot easier. But my touring is not the way that it used to be. Mm-hmm. I won't, you know, go out on a 3-week tour or whatever.
Right.
So a lot of times it's piecing things together and like, is our whole family going to go? So it's so many additional logistics.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And thankfully he also is into routing and efficiency. So, but yeah, I love learning that about Catch too.
Like, yeah, he's like so into geography too, so he knows where every little town is and like every little airport.
I bet. I mean, especially coming up the way
Old Crow did.
Yeah, he did with his band. I'm sure they've played all of those small towns and driven all those back roads and like
yeah, and I feel like it'd be helpful to have just the perspective in your everyday life of someone who has lived all of the ups and downs of careers, of like explosive moments. And I would imagine I'm not that intimate with Old Crow's trajectory, but times of kind of stasis or band
reinvention.
Yeah, reinvention, personnel change. Because I think, again, one of the myths that we're like constantly dispelling on this podcast that even people who've lived it are constantly having to recenter in is a music career is not a steady incline. It's so up and down. There's no guarantee if you have a great year, that doesn't mean next year's going to be great.
Right. Yeah.
It's not like being a doctor and just moving. Although I'm probably going to have a doctor comment and be like, you don't know what it's like to be a doctor. Like, I know I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I used to relate as a side person. I used to relate it a little bit to being a doctor. You know, I was like constantly on call, like waiting for my phone to ring, like, cool, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, cool, oh, great, I can do that, sure.
You work really weird hours.
Working really weird hours, yeah, exactly. I just, for some reason, the paycheck didn't
super high pressure of no mistakes from those bluegrass fans that are mad at you for playing with Molly Tuttle.
I did have to go to a lot of therapy because I thought the two shows that I played with Molly, the band was amazing, but then we'd step off stage and Molly would play by herself and everybody would just go absolutely crazy. I'm like, we don't need to be here. We don't need to be here.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Just thinking of like the stories when he would tour with Stray Birds and people would just be like,
oh yeah,
leave the drums, please.
Oh my gosh.
Oh man. I literally had somebody again in the back parking lot of a show. We were all standing out there after a show and this person looks across me at Maya, like I'm in between this person and Maya, this fan, he goes, does he ride in the van? Not sarcastically, not as a joke. Like, seriously, was wondering if I rode in the van.
They don't let you.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
How shielded are you from comments or feedback from fans? Do you read comments or are you?
I read them a little bit. Like I have Instagram on my phone a lot of the time. Sometimes I'll delete it just because I need a break, but I'll look at comments. I definitely feel like if I see a mean comment, it might hurt my feelings, but most of the time I just see positive feedback. And then if I'm like struggling with it too much, I'll just kind of stop looking at it, I guess. So yeah. I don't think I have like the world's healthiest relationship with social media, but I don't let it get me spiraling too much or like out of control. I don't think it like derails my life, but I probably could stand to look at it less.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of, do I know anybody besides our child's preschool teacher who doesn't go on social media, who doesn't say, I don't think I have the healthiest relationship with social media.
Yeah,
I'll delete it sometimes when I'm home, especially because I know I don't have to be like on tour. Sometimes I like to do little updates throughout the day and just kind of post more candid stuff. But then when I'm home, I find myself just zoning out and looking at it too much. So I'll delete it.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like on tour, I just become sort of a robot anyway, where I'm like, after a while on the road, I'm just kind of like, meh. Don't really care if I look at my phone all day. But then when I'm home, I want to actually like get into a good routine and stuff.
Yeah, that is very difficult on tour. If you're just sitting around either like in a van or even in the green room or something to just mindlessly
scroll.
There's just
so much time.
That's a really hard part of how to be like, okay, the 22 hours that you're not on stage, of how to live that intentionally when mm-hmm. also you're playing a lot of the same songs and like putting on a show, and how sometimes it can get a little robotic of just, okay, I'm doing this again. Do you have any ways that you try and reinvigorate when it's a long tour and you're like, all right, I've played this song a million times. I'm tired. I've stared at my phone. How do I reconnect here?
I feel like the show itself for me, even if I've played a song a million times, it's still so much fun because I love connecting with the audience, and it's mm-hmm. like little moments of spontaneity or the moments in between songs when I'm talking to the crowd or things that make each show special. But sometimes I just get nervous about adding a new song to the set, and I have to really break out of that and try to push myself to take those risks and change the set list and try something new each night. And a lot of times that keeps me on my toes more for the show and makes it a more energetic, exciting show.
Yeah, that always feels like a balance. Sometimes having the same set can create freedom because you know, mm-hmm. like,
you're okay, so relaxed.
I know. Yeah, I'm relaxed. I know what's coming. I know what kind of like stories I might tell. If I'm on a tour opening for people, I always feel a little self-conscious for the headlining act if they like hear me at all, because I'm just like, I'm locked into what this 30-minute set is and I'm not changing it because I don't want to go over.
If it's a really short set, sometimes it's just you don't want to go over your allotted time by accident or go under by accident. I was just doing that on tour with Tyler Childers because some of the sets I was doing 45, some I was doing 30, but I just like to have the timing dead on so I didn't accidentally go over. So I was pretty much keeping the set the same just because I knew the song lengths would be the same.
Totally. And I can also imagine that, you know, when you are support, you're playing to a borrowed audience. So you find part of your catalog and your songs that resonate with their audience.
Right.
Versus having your own audience where you can like, I'm playing my art. You came to see my art.
Yeah.
So that's, I would imagine that's part of it.
Yeah. I feel like if I'm opening for the Wood Brothers versus the Milk Carton Kids, I play different songs of mine. Mm-hmm. Or like totally. When I was on tour with the Wood Brothers, we were playing like a mix of big theaters and then rock clubs. And I remember it was a Friday night in Buffalo and their manager was like, just a heads up, you're going to have to fight for this one. And I was like, what? And he was like, we've played Buffalo several times and it is a rowdy crowd.
I've played Buffalo maybe once or twice and the crowd was so much fun. They were just like shouting stuff the whole time. Yeah. I was shocked because I don't think I'd played there before until 2 years ago. I had no expectations. I was like, whoa, Buffalo goes so hard.
Yeah. This crowd was like, I was like, all right, I'm not going to play my slow songs or kind of try and tell stories, because they were like, they're ready to party. And I was just by myself and I'm not like a lead guitar player. So I was like, all right, I'm going to play some up-tempo fun songs, because they were like so, there were bar fights happening by the end of the night. People were getting thrown out from like fighting each other.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was wild.
I kind of wanted to tie a question about this shift from Golden Highway to like your new record and all of that and tie it back to like, you know, there was our conversation about like reading the comments and then also about like team and all of that. How was your experience with that transition? I mean, I know you had written the music, you had recorded it, you knew it was coming, but like, I would assume the audience is used to seeing Golden Highway. There's shows that are booked for that. Then there's venues that really work for that music. And there's venues that really work for your new music.
Right.
Like, I guess I want to know twofold. Like, how did you guys navigate that technically? Like, did your team have a good running start to set expectations, all that? And then also, secondly, like, how has that been for you with the reception to like this new art that you've put out and this new creative vision that you've brought to life?
I felt so excited and like just kind of reinvigorated by the new record. And I feel like we did have to have conversations about like, how do we create a middle ground between the show being so different and then also incorporating some of the material that I would play with Golden Highway. Like, I didn't want to completely create like a totally new show from scratch and abandon everything I'd been working on before. So that's where like just pulling from the bluegrass material, maybe like reinventing some of it and doing some of it in a more acoustic way, that helped. It just took us a little bit to kind of find that balance and like get the band fully comfortable with all the material and dialed in. So yeah, it was definitely like a learning curve, but I think we had so many shows and by the end of the year, I felt like it was just getting so dialed in and so exciting. So I think going into our second year, now I'm like, okay, what new stuff can we work up? I want to mix up the set list more and more and still kind of keep that bluegrass element to it, but also be able to expand from there. So I feel like the response, people were sort of surprised, but I guess I toured with the bluegrass band for 3 years. And before that, like we talked about, I played with drums. I'd made a couple mm-hmm. solo records that weren't bluegrass. Mm-hmm. So for me, it just felt kind of a continuation of my solo project, which is part of the reason why I came up with the band name Golden Highway. I wanted to just differentiate my bluegrass work so that I could have that be its own thing, because it's such a big part of what I do. And then if I make a solo project, I just kind of feel free to explore different genres. Maybe I'll make a solo album that's more bluegrass leaning than this last one next, but I did kind of like having the Golden Highway records feel like I was working with a set of genre parameters and really paying tribute mm-hmm. to the music that I grew up with.
Yeah, I love that idea of using, like, I guess a moniker mm-hmm. or a band name to really kind of delineate what is what and kind of set expectations with the audience.
Yeah, and for fans to be like, yeah, this isn't a left turn for me. This is a continuation of what I've been doing. I've focused on this for a little bit. I'm returning mm-hmm. to this thing and also just continually growing as an artist mm-hmm. that's not limited.
Yeah.
I think is really beautiful.
Have you had the same team for a while? Agent, manager, and mm-hmm. all that?
Yeah, I've had the same agents for a really long time. I'm trying to think when I signed on with them. I might have had them for like 8 years. I think I've had the same agents. I've worked with my manager since, I want to say 2021, maybe the end of 2020. Now it's all kind of blurring in my mm-hmm. mind.
For sure.
Yeah, I've had the same team for the last three album cycles, management-wise, and my booking agents were sort of my first puzzle piece that fell into place, and they were so helpful for me, like just kind of putting together the rest of the team. Now I've worked with Nonesuch for 3 albums. I started with them on my Crooked Tree album. Yeah, and that's about the time I started working with my managers, Kevin and Michelle. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Are they equally on board for chasing down this variety? Are they like up for the challenge of like, okay, how do we market this?
Yeah, everyone was really excited about the new music and, you know, trying to reach a new audience, not a new audience, but like expanding mm-hmm. the audience, I guess. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess the business side of things, it's like they're just kind of looking for like any opportunities that new music could bring, and they're not trying to like keep me in one lane, I guess.
Yeah amazing. I ask all these questions because in my perception, a lot of people getting success with an approach, with a record, with a sound, like mm-hmm. I find that people, and this is a generality, not everybody obviously, can tend to like cling on to that, be like, oh, this is what works. Yeah. I guess this is my sound because it works, you know, and I don't see you doing that, you know, so the support that you have for that is incredible. And like, I'm envious of a situation, you know, you obviously have such a clear vision. Oh, I want to do this. Oh, I want to make this. And like, it seems like a creative exploration, like in the best sense. That's what like lights me up.
We're always talking maybe like one or two records ahead. Like even just today, mm-hmm. we're like talking about 2 records from now. Like, what am I going to mm-hmm. do next year after I record my next album? So I think that just sort of sets everyone's expectations. And the whole team is just kind of on board and excited to do the best they can to support the music, which is really, I feel really fortunate to work with such a supportive group of people. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's been really cool. And I think too, like coming from the bluegrass and more like Americana roots world, people are just more in it because they love the music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People aren't trying to sell millions and millions of records. I mean, you would love for that to happen, but I think in a way that does kind of weed out some of the like pressure of you have mm-hmm. to do this certain thing because we all need to make this much money or whatever. Mm-hmm, I don't know. Yeah. It's just, there's more freedom to just be an artist and
totally
do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Nonesuch, I know there's been a change of personnel, but it's still a lot of the same people that were there when I worked there.
Yeah,
for sure.
And that really informed for me the experience of, oh, like working a record label is only as good as the people who are working there. Mm-hmm. And when you have people who are supportive and excited, obviously while also having to manage business expectations, but when the foundation is in art versus mm-hmm. we're a pop label that has to make millions of dollars, otherwise it's deemed a failure.
Right.
It creates a lot more freedom and, in my opinion, better culture and music.
Yeah, there are such good people over there, like just super artist friendly. And I was always such a big fan of the label too before signing with them. I had mm-hmm. so many bands that I loved that were on Nonesuch. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's been fun working with them.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. I know we're on
thank you guys.
Always be mindful of time. We always end with the same last question, which is you get to pick. And I always lob it over to Aaron because my brain can't ever remember what they are. So Aaron.
Yeah.
I blame my children for not sleeping.
Valid. Yeah, it's basically like a choose your own adventure. Either something that someone has told you or that you've read, some kind of wisdom that has been imparted on you along your journey that continues to like resonate with you and keep you inspired and fill your cup. Or conversely, something that you wish you knew back when you were at Berkeley and going to Sweden and starting to make a viable career out of your creativity.
I guess it's like so simple, but just trust your gut and like always follow your own intuition on if something feels like the right decision or the right musical creative choice or business decision. That was something that like I had to learn. So you can have all these people telling you like this is what you should do, but if your heart is telling you something different, then it's probably better in the long run to trust yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Is that something that you had to learn through action or?
Yeah, I think so. There's just been not anything that was crazy that happened, but you know, there's times when you are like, oh, I actually really wanted to do that one thing that came up and I said no, or vice versa. Like I said yes to this obligation and it's actually something my heart wasn't really in, and that's tough when it's like a creative pursuit.
Yeah,
for sure. I mean, to bring up the milk carton kids again, they were one of the first conversations we had on this podcast 150 something episodes ago. And Joey had this great paradigm shift in what he said. He's like, you know, when you're saying yes to one thing, you're saying no to all these other things.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. It's a helpful thing to remember. Regardless, you're missing out on something. So when you think you're like turning something down, you're saying yes to all these other possibilities as well.
Yeah. Well, Molly, thank you for making time for us.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Yeah, have a good day.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, JD McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.